and which are left out. We've been noticing that the New Testament era was a fluid, dynamic situation. And there's an example of that in Acts chapter 15 that actually produced and gives us an idea of the kinds of circumstances that were present in the New Testament. Verse 1 tells us that there were men who came from Judea, from Jerusalem, evidently, which is, of course, located in Judea. I think I probably should put this mic on. Probably was intended for me to do that anyway. And they came seemingly with apostolic authority. They came down and they said, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And that kicked off this huge debate that resulted in what we read a little bit later in the chapter where the brethren come together, in fact, apostles come together. And so what we have here is a circumstance where there is a claim made that God wants you to do something, and in fact, God had not made that claim. In this case, this was an oral rather than a written message, but it also, in this case, resulted in a written message, a letter that was sent out. For example, in verse 15, the words of the prophets agree, and James quotes the scripture there as he cites Amos chapter 9, beginning at verse 11. And then after they make this decision in verse 19, not to trouble the Gentiles except these four things, it seemed good to the apostles and elders to choose men to send a letter in verse 23. Now, we might not recognize this as a letter on the same level as Ephesians or Colossians, but that's exactly what it was. This is a letter sent with apostolic authority. It is recorded for us not as a separate epistle, in the same way that there are, of course, seven letters to churches which are recorded for us in John's Apocalypse or in his Revelation. But this is a letter that circulated among churches and was sent out with the letter and with men accompanying the letter to testify as to the apostolic authority of this particular letter. And so that really always has been the key to this issue of canonicity as we have been talking about. Now, what I want to do this morning for just a few moments is to return to this theme of these apocryphal or so-called hidden gospels. We were only able to touch on that barely last year at the very end. And I want to spend a little more time with it this time around. And then this afternoon we will have some concluding remarks. Our lesson this morning at the worship hour will be a kind of a takeaway application type of lesson. What does all of this mean, and why should it be meaningful to us? And what kind of impact should it have on our lives? What should we do about all of this would be the idea, or maybe not do. Just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, do we need to kill this light here? That might be better for people to be able to see what's on the screen, possibly. This, of course, as I indicated Friday night, is a very popular topic. It's covered widely in the press. It's on, these kinds of books come out, they're on CNN, they're on the National Geographic Channel, they're on the History Channel, they're on, as I indicated, Bart Ehrman's been on the Jon Stewart Show, which I guess kind of means you've arrived in this culture. But what some people are saying, this was when the National Geographic Society produced this book, The Gospel of Judas, that we discussed in some detail last year, actually. These Gospels demonstrate the rich diversity within early Christianity. Well, they indicate that there were ideas different than what you read in the Bible, that's to be sure, that there were heretics abroad, that there were people teaching things that are not in the Bible. We knew that from the Bible. We don't need the National Geographic Society to tell us that there were people in the New Testament era who were going around disturbing Christians, teaching from church to church things other than what is in the Scripture. If that's a news headline, then all I can say is these folks probably should have read their Bible a little bit more carefully, because that is not exactly what you would call a news flash. A woman who teaches at Yale University, published in the New York Times, puts it this way: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are only a small selection of Gospels from among the dozens that circulated among early Christian groups. Now, that's my emphasis, not hers. But in order to understand where the controversy about some of these things come in, you have to kind of be able to pick up on the little kind of key words that either put up a red flag or may make a sentence that sounds like it might be true, really more false than true. And that, I would remind us again, is how falsehood often comes to us, not as something that's 100% false, that's so obviously wrong that anybody could spot it. Error is the more effective when it comes wrapped in a bit of truth, when it's festooned with ideas that would be attractive and would be true, but it's that small kernel of error, perhaps, that sometimes escapes our notice. These circulated among early Christian groups, as we're going to see, not early enough, not nearly early enough for these so-called apocryphal or hidden gospels. Spectacular discovery, she says, are exploding the myth of a monolithic Christianity, a Christianity that was unified and had one view. Well, again, there's a kernel of truth there. Yet there were groups out there that had different ideas about the nature of Christ, about what one did to become a Christian. It really wasn't all that different from today, as we're going to see in our next hour's lesson. There were all kinds of people who were trying to change the Scripture more by adding books or circulating books that they hoped would become popular enough maybe to become a part of the canon, the list, the rule of books approved or accepted among the churches, rather, because it was usually too difficult to get those ideas into existing manuscripts, into existing documents. Scribes generally would not make those kinds of changes. Sometimes accidental changes, in fact, crept in. But usually, false doctrine had to be these variations among Christians were introduced by somebody writing an entirely different letter. So she says what these letters do, what these gospels do, is show that people had different ideas about God. Duh. No kidding. You don't mean it. Again, this is hardly a newsflash. She also goes on to say they show how diverse and fascinating the early Christian movement really was. Well, of course, that's very much a 20th century, 21st century view that diversity, one of the big buzzwords of our era, is good. And everybody has a different opinion. Opinions are kind of like noses, you know. Everybody's got one, and mine's just as good as yours, and yours are just as good as mine. And we're all just in this sort of big religious cafeteria, and everybody gets to pick whatever they want to believe. One out of column A, two out of column B, whatever it is, mix and match, you know, that kind of thing. Sort of like eating off a Chinese menu. Well, that's the sort of prevailing view that many people bring to these sort of things, and our modern diverse culture has in some ways opened the door for this sort of thing, for people to read back into the first century the kinds of ideas and concepts that we have in the 21st. Now, these apocryphal gospels, that word simply means hidden, just to remind us of the word definition. These gospels that were heretical, they were known among first century and early second century churches and after as they were introduced. Most of them actually were not written until after that time. But they were known and rejected. For example, the Gospel of Judas, as much as any writing from antiquity, shows that there were other points of view passionately and reverently espoused by people who called themselves Christians. Now, just take the Gospel of Judas out of this and ask yourself if that doesn't describe the current situation. That there are other points of view passionately and reverently espoused by people who call themselves Christians. There are all kinds of people in this country today and in other countries in the world who believe different things about what being a Christian is and how you become a Christian. But did they get their ideas from the New Testament? Or did they have to get these ideas from other sources? In many ways, we're talking about the same kind of problem that we face today in a diverse religious culture. Early Christians faced the same kind of thing in their own day and time. These alternative views show us there were enormous struggles within early Christianity over the proper forms of belief and practice. Well, that's Ehrman's idea. I don't know how much of a struggle there was, because generally these false ideas, including those from the Gospel of Judas, were rejected. Robert Funk, who's another well-known name, Ehrman is sort of the scholar du jour. Somebody else will come along next year or the year after that and replace him on the talk show circuit. Before Ehrman, there was Funk. A second version, he says, of the New Testament should contain the current 27 books plus others, such as the Sayings Gospel, Q. You may be aware of the fact that Q is a sort of it's a mythological document. Nobody knows if it really existed. It's called Q because it's short for the German word Quell or source. And the idea is that there was this document that circulated among the early Christians long since lost, from which Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John drew quotations that made their way into the Gospels that they wrote down. Well, there may very well have been such a document. I mean, we don't know that there was. It doesn't exist. It's a sort of part of somebody's fictitious or a figment of their imagination. It's a fictitious document. But suppose it did. That doesn't mean that it was inspired. There were lots of documents that circulated. In fact, we're reading from the book of Acts. Come back to Luke's gospel in the very beginning. The same person who wrote the book of Acts tells us in verse 1 of Luke, chapter 1, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us. Because that's true, he's saying, I want to write to you something that I know to be fact based on eyewitness testimony, about which we're going to talk more at the 1:30 lesson. But the very introductory remarks of the Gospel of Luke make it clear there were many documents that were circulating before Luke wrote his Gospel. Many people had decided we ought to write down what the words of the Lord are. I heard him say this. I heard him say that. My brother-in-law heard him say something else. Somebody else told me they heard him say this. So, without question, Jesus and his life and teaching would, without doubt, have stirred up enough interest that people very likely would have, in fact, not likely, Luke says, they did. There were already many accounts of the life of Christ that were circulating. But since that's true, he said, inasmuch as that's true, come to verse 3, it seemed fitting for me as well. I want to write something to kind of set the record straight, is what he's saying. Having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. Now, what Funk is saying, and other people, is we ought to take this... that's a very interesting comment, because I don't know how he would publish Q. I mean, that we have a document called the Sayings Gospel. There is a document called the Gospel of Judas. I mean, there's a whole book published that has the fragments. It's not whole, and it has a lot of nonsense in it. But at least we have a document. Q doesn't exist. So I don't know how you would publish a non-existent document. That's almost a nonsensical statement. The Gospel of Thomas, and so forth and so on. But that's some idea of the kind of nonsense, quite frankly, that circulates in the public press and the public media. Well, all right, how should we react to that? Well, number one, these so-called hidden early Christian Gospels are simply not early enough to be apostolic. They're way too late. Now, they're not early enough, by which I mean they're not first century. They all stem from at least the second century or later, so that you have in the first century, if you draw a kind of a bright demarcation line at the end of the first century, and you would have probably the Gospel of Mark, almost certainly the Gospel of Mark first, Luke, Acts, Matthew, John, probably later around the time that John was very likely writing the Apocalypse. You're probably aware that there's a discussion even among brethren as to when John wrote Revelation. There's a sort of a minority school that used to be more popular than it is today, which says that John wrote Revelation before A.D. 70. It's possible, to be sure, although I think not very likely. And clearly, John was writing, and his gospel bears the marks of something that perhaps was written a bit later. Most people are aware that it's written from a different perspective. But all of these gospels, I think it is clear to say from anybody who doesn't have an axe to grind or an agenda, as W.F. Albright, the leading American archaeologist, said before he died 30 years ago, that there's not much doubt that all of these Gospels were written by first century Jews in the first century. Now, we don't need somebody from Johns Hopkins to tell us that if we already believe what the Bible says. But somebody who says differently has a kind of an axe to grind. All of these other books, like, and there are dozens more, but some of the more famous ones, the Gospel of the Hebrews, the Apocryphon of James, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, the infancy narratives, yada, 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 on and on and on. All of these date from the second century or later. They're simply not early enough to be apostolic, and they were known and rejected. That's really the next and kind of main point that we need to talk about by the early church. Now, just to give you an example, since we've been talking about text criticism, here's a little bit of an exercise. If you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 2, in fact, turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 2, in the middle column, there is a quotation in that chapter where the Apostle Paul is quoting from a text that looks very much, sounds very much like one that's found in Isaiah 64. If you want to put your marker in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9, which says, since I've asked you to turn there, as it is written, so an intentional quotation from the Old Testament, things which eye has not seen, this is the New American Standard Version, slightly different from what's on the screen. Let me make a point about that, by the way. What's on the screen, what eye has not seen and ear has not heard, it's a very stripped down, very literal translation, and have not arisen in the heart of man. Those are the phrases that echo what we're going to read in Isaiah chapter 64, which have not entered the heart of man all that God has prepared for those who love Him. Now, if you come back to Isaiah 64, put your marker or your thumb there in 1 Corinthians, come back to the 64th chapter of Isaiah, and notice the text that is under consideration. And sometimes you may notice that when you turn back and read some of these Old Testament quotations, they don't altogether exactly match what you read in the New Testament. The reason for that is, most of the time anyway, is that what we have in our English Old Testaments are directly translated from Hebrew into English. The Old Testament quotations in the New Testament were used by Jesus very likely, and certainly the apostles, from the Septuagint version. That is, when they quoted the Old Testament, they didn't quote it directly from the Hebrew. Why not, you may wonder? Well, the answer is because very few people spoke Hebrew at that time. And they certainly didn't read the Bible in Hebrew. They were not able to read the Bible in Hebrew, just like most of us are not able to read the Bible in Hebrew. They had to read it from a translation. And the translation they read from in their day and time, like we read from an English translation, they read from the Septuagint, the Greek translation, the common language translation of the Old Testament. They didn't usually go back and read it. Now, some of them could. Paul, for example, when he's giving us his list of credentials in Philippians, he says, after he tells us he was a Pharisee, he was the tribe of Benjamin. In fact, he was named for the first king, who was also a Benjamite. He was named for Saul. And then he says, I am a Hebrew of Hebrews. Well, hadn't he already told us that? I mean, obviously, if he's a Pharisee, if he's a Jew, if he knows his tribe, if he's a Benjamite, he's a Hebrew, right? Well, Hebrew of Hebrews is not simply repetition. That's an idiomatic phrase. It's a phrase they used, and what it meant was, I am a Hebrew-speaking child of Hebrew-speaking parents. I don't need to have somebody translate the Bible for me. I grew up in a home where they spoke and read Hebrew, and I speak and read Hebrew, and I don't need you to tell me what it says. It was a badge of distinction, because very few people could do that. But Paul says, I can. And I didn't have to go to rabbinical school to learn that. Now, he probably learned maybe a deeper understanding of Hebrew when he was in rabbinical school, but he grew up in a home where they spoke and read Hebrew, and where the Hebrew Bible was read. But most Jews in the first century couldn't do that. They had to get their Bible, their knowledge of the Old Testament, by reading it in translation. And that's why when you read in the New Testament quotations from the Old, you're reading quotations that have been filtered or washed through Greek. Now come back to Isaiah 64 and look at the text here. For from of old they have not heard nor perceived by ear, neither has the eye seen a God besides thee who acts in behalf of the one who waits in him. Paul takes a part of that text and uses it as a jumping off place to discuss in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 what God has done, and this is a text in which he's talking about revelation. Some people read this text in 1 Corinthians 2:9 and they think, oh, I was talking about heaven. And that does really make a pretty good description of what heaven will be like. It'd be a place no eye has seen it. No ear can really hear what's going on. It really hasn't entered into the heart of man all that God has prepared for those who love him. If you just ripped those words right out of their context, yeah, that might make a pretty good description of heaven. But that's not what he's talking about here. What he's talking about is the revelation of God. What he's saying is, this is the text that we read the other evening in verse 11, who among man knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of man which is in him? Nobody knows what you're thinking except you. There may be people who know you well enough, a wife, husband, mother, father, whatever, to be able to maybe accurately discern what you're thinking. My wife says sometimes she can tell what I'm thinking even before I think it, but sometimes I fool her. She's pretty good, though, but she's not 100% accurate. If I choose to reveal what's on my mind, then you have a choice either of believing what I say or disbelieving based on whether you know me to be a truth teller or not. If I'm known to be an habitual liar, then you probably would want to take anything I said with a grain of salt. But if you know me to be a truth teller and I say, here's what I'm really thinking about that, then you can choose to believe that or not. And Paul is saying that's exactly the way it is with God. Nobody knows what's on the mind of God except the Spirit of God. Fortunately for us, God and His Spirit decided to reveal to us what's on His mind, what He thinks, what He wants us to do, what He designed us to be able to do, what He expects of us. And what Paul is saying in verse 9 is that we don't learn that by human eye or human ear. We don't learn it by experimentation. We don't learn it by historical research. We don't learn it by intuition. We learn it how? We learn it because the Spirit of God has revealed it to us. Spiritual thoughts combined with spiritual words. These texts go together. So what Paul is doing here, he's quoting from Isaiah 64, or using at least a part of that text, as a springboard to talk to us, to talk to the Corinthians and us by extension about inspiration, about revelation. Now, look at what happens with this text. Obviously, 1 Corinthians 2:9 borrows from Isaiah 64 and borrows intentionally. Paul says, that's what as it is written. We have not heard, he quotes it from the Septuagint, what eye has not seen, ear has not heard, we have not heard, our eyes have not seen. Now, look at the Gospel of Thomas and just do a little basic text criticism here. Which document does Thomas borrow from? And which of these documents was later? Thomas 17 says, I will give you what eye has not seen and what ear has not heard and what hand has not touched and what has not arisen in the heart of man. Obviously, a text that uses words but also inserts words, this in other words, is a later text. It has all the earmarks. It's not something that borrowed directly. It is dependent upon, more upon what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2 than on Isaiah 64. Now, that's just a basic little exercise in what you can do if you have, in this case, just three texts. Imagine trying to do this with hundreds of copies of these texts. And the point is, when you have hundreds of copies of these texts, then you can really triangulate and become very accurate in terms of what the text actually says. My point here is that just on a basic, on the face of a comparison, what you have is a much later text that uses, relies upon something that's earlier, in this case, 1 Corinthians 2, just as Paul is relying earlier upon what is said or parts of what are in Isaiah 64, Isaiah chapter 64. So the larger point I'm making here is these texts, like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, the infancy narratives, they're too late. They're not apostolic. They may borrow apostolic doctrine and teaching, or they may contradict it, but they're not apostolic. Here's another example from the Gospel of Thomas, and this time I've not put them in the order in which they were written. Now, I've given you a clue. Tatian, in the right-hand column, the Diatessaron, was written about 175 AD. That's a document that's known, is not inspired. He doesn't argue, so far as I recall, that it is inspired. But it's a commentary which says, foxes have their holes and then there's something missing. Birds have their nest, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Now that's familiar to us because it's recorded in Matthew 8:20 and Luke 9:50. You can turn to those verses in the Bible and read that. The Gospel of Thomas also has a passage that reads like that. Foxes have their holes and birds have their nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head and rest. Here's the question. Which source does the Gospel of Thomas use? Or if you wanted to just, which of these sources is earliest? And which relies on the other text? And then which of them relies on maybe both of the preceding texts? Well, obviously, foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, or and the birds of the air nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay the head. If you look at a known document from 175 AD in the right-hand column, foxes have their holes and omits the word the and the phrase of the air. That's what those blank lines mean. Birds have their nest, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head and rest. That's almost identical to Matthew 18 and Luke 9:50, except it omits a word in one clause and a phrase from another. Now, if you look at the Gospel of Thomas and notice how heavily it relies not so much on Matthew 8, but relies on this AD 175 document. Foxes have their holes, and it omits the word that's in the Gospels in the same way that the Diatessaron does. Birds have their nest, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head and rest, identical to the 175 document, but different from the Gospels. Now, anybody who's done text crit can look at that and say, you've got the Gospel, you've got a later document known to date from 175, and then you've got the Gospel of Thomas, that all these people we had on the screen before, Funk and Poggles and all these people, Ehrman, are saying why they're early. They're not early. This one is obviously after 175. It borrows from a known document 100 years after the Gospels were being written. These simply are not early enough to have been apostolic or Christian. And let's talk about literary genre for a moment. That's a big buzzword in text criticism and in understanding the Bible. These things are non-Gospels. I mean, they call themselves Gospels, but in terms of genre, in terms of literary form, they are not like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Well, how are they not like them? Well, number one, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are biographies. That is, they contain biographical information about the Lord and some details about His disciples. You read these Gnostic Gospels, they're not biographies, they're dialogues. Now, they may have some vignettes, some occasional little snippet of Jesus did this when He was a boy and so forth, but they're not really meant to put together any sort of coherent life of Christ, if you will, like you get in the Gospels. Now, we understand that the Gospels are not full-scale biographies. There's a lot we're not told. There's a lot about the boyhood of Jesus we're not told. It focuses on His adulthood, and especially on the ministry portion, when He began teaching of His adulthood. But it is composed in a style, in a literary genre, that's recognizable as historical and biographical. When you read these other Gospels, that's not what they are. They're different. A major point of difference is, it's obvious in the Gospels that they continue the Old Testament. Whereas most of these Gnostic Gospels, they are really allergic to the Old. They think the Old Testament was bad. The reason is, and I need to ask David, what time does this trapdoor drop here? What time do I quit? 10:15. All right, that's good. I was afraid it was 5 after or 10 after. Gnosticism was a collection of doctrines that had different versions and changed over time, but one of the main things is that which is created is bad. That which is physical is bad. The flesh is bad. The body is bad. Practically speaking, what that led them to believe is that you should either really buffet the body, abuse the body, cut the body, whip the body, lie on a bed of nails or something, or the more popular version of that is, if the body is fleshly and evil and sinful and it's going to do what it's going to do, then let it do what it's going to do and just enjoy the ride. If it wants to drink, let it drink. If it wants to fornicate, let it fornicate. If it wants to whatever, if it wants to eat, let it eat. Now, you can guess which of those versions of Gnosticism is more popular. Lie on a bed of nails and cut yourself and bleed and whip yourself into submission, or do what comes naturally. Which of those is an easier sell? But they're both rooted in the idea that physical things are bad and what you want to do is to become spiritual. Now, there's some relationship maybe in that idea to some things we find in the New Testament, although the New Testament does not present the body or the flesh as bad or as evil. It's neutral. Romans 6 and other passages make it very clear. The body can be used for great good or it can be used for great evil. These guys, the Gnostics, that was heresy to them. And an even greater heresy would be to teach about a God who actually created the physical world? Oh, no. You couldn't be a Gnostic and endorse that. So anything from the Old Testament, generally speaking, they're just highly allergic to that. The Gospels obviously are rooted in monotheism because they are a continuation of the covenant that was made by the one true God. You shall have no other gods beside me. That idea is continued in the New Testament. The Gnostic myths had all kinds of gods. The Gospels are embedded in history. They name names. They give us place names that you can go to today. They're places that have been excavated in many instances. There's not a galaxy far, far away, long, long ago. Whereas most of these Gnostic Gospels are totally unhistorical. They're just not like the Gospels. And in a sense, we really do even the term Gospel a disservice by calling these documents Gospels. I mean, even in terms of literary genre, it's just not an accurate description of what these documents are. So again, I'll come back to my point. If you read these things, what I'm saying, you don't have to take my word for it. The best evidence is just go read some of this stuff. You'll get tired of it pretty quickly, I guarantee you. But take a spin with the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Judas. Get a copy, download them on the web most of the time. Now, there are all kinds of inconsistencies. You want to contrast between these Gospels? I mean, when these folks are saying, yeah, there was a wide diversity of views, let's check it out. Jesus, according to the Gospel of Thomas, performs no miracles. He speaks no prophecies. He doesn't die for anyone's sins. He will not accept anybody's faith in himself. Salvation is based on your accumulation of the knowledge of secret teaching. Gnosis, the Greek word for knowledge, and especially hidden knowledge. Something you know that nobody else knows. Let me tell you a secret. Actually, I won't tell you a secret because I know it, and I'm better than you. Because I know something you don't know. So if you can accumulate all this secret teaching, that makes you better. You don't really want to share it with anybody else unless you know the club code handshake or whatever it may happen to be. That's how you advance to the next level and eventually may achieve salvation. It's based on knowledge. The Gospel of Judas. According to the Gospel of Judas, the creator of the world is not the one true God. The world was created an evil place to be escaped. That's not what the Bible teaches about God's creation of the world. Now, evil entered the world through the evil one, but God created the garden good. And a place, in fact, where He could dwell with mankind. He didn't create the world as an evil place. According to the Gospel of Judas, Jesus Christ is not the Son of the Creator. I mean, if the Creator is bad because He created physical things, then Jesus couldn't be His Son and be a good person. So we got to separate those two, would be the idea. Salvation does not come through the death and resurrection of Jesus. Salvation, again, rather comes through this accumulation of secret knowledge, which in this case, Jesus provides. He's the sort of conduit to this secret information. And as you might guess in the Gospel of Judas, Judas Iscariot is the hero, not Jesus, who is exalted and transported to heaven. That's what the Gospel of Judas is about, at least insofar as we can tell. Well, let me just share a couple of my really favorite passages. This is from the Gospel of Judas. Simon Peter said to them, "Make Mary leave us, for females don't deserve life." Now, there are some people who want to make a case that the New Testament is anti-feminist, anti-women. Let me tell you, if you think that's true, I don't believe that it is. But there are some people who want to take pass and do that. They don't hold a candle to some of this. Jesus said, according to the Gospel of Judas, "Look, I will guide her to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit representing or resembling rather you males. For every female who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." You want to know how to be saved? Live in an age of sex change operations, I guess. Or let Jesus make you male, all of you women out there. I think I've got another one in here. Yes, from the infancy Gospel of Thomas. On another occasion, this Gospel tells us, Jesus was passing through the village and a child ran by and jostled him on his shoulder, which made Jesus upset. And he said to him, "You won't finish your journey." And at once the child fell down and died. Now, you remember the big stink that we talked about the other night that Ehrman talks about whether in Mark's account of the Gospel, Jesus viewed the crowd either with anger or with pity or compassion. And he thinks that that one text alters the whole tenor of Mark's Gospel, even though it is clear in other texts that Jesus showed both pity and compassion. But we want to exalt something like this to a point of equality with the Gospel of Mark? You must be joking. I mean, I sometimes wonder if these people really think folks are going to take this seriously. Or if they think maybe if they say something outlandish enough, it'll get them on CNN or get them a book contract or something like that. You have to kind of wonder about some of this. A published cue? Now, that would be a headline if you could publish a non-existent document. That would really be something. All right, so they're not Gospels, and they're not hidden. They weren't hidden. They were not unknown. They were known to these early Christians, but they were rejected. Irenaeus, in his Against Heresies, they declare that Judas, the traitor, was thoroughly acquainted with these things and that he alone, knowing the truth as no others did, accomplished the mystery of the betrayal. By him all things, both earthly and heavenly, were thus thrown into confusion. They produce, meaning people who write the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Judas, they produce a fictitious history of this kind, which they style the Gospel of Judas. The Gospel of Judas was not discovered in the 20th century. It was rediscovered then, and it lay in a drawer for 30 years, until National Geographic Channel decided to make a big deal out of it. It was known by these folks back then, by name and by substance, and it was rejected as fictitious history, something that is not true. Another quotation, "Let none read the Gospel according to Thomas, for it is the work not of one of the 12 apostles, but one of the three wicked disciples of Manus." He names a name of a philosophical or religious school and says, it's wrong, it's bad, it's fictitious, and let me tell you who really wrote it. It is not written by Thomas. It's written by this particular school of thought or actual school over there. Now, you know, there were lists that began to appear pretty early on that record for us what books were generally accepted and were not. And I want to make the point again that it's not appearance on a list that makes something canonical or not. It's the fact that it appears on a list, that it was accepted by the churches, that does that. But it's just pretty impressive by contrast. I'm not saying that just because it's on somebody's list that necessarily makes it, but look at the difference between the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the Gospel of Thomas or Judas or the Gospel of Truth or the 12 or the Gospel of Peter, etc., etc., on down the line. If they were known, and many of them became known later on, they were rejected. In only a couple of instances did anybody compiling a list and saying these are books that probably ought to be read in the churches and accepted as apostolic, did anybody even consider that? Just if you take just the weight of the evidence, and my point is, again, these were known and decided on. Well, all right, let me close with this. We have maybe 5 minutes. We talked about this the other night. There is a view of the canon, the rule, that says that the church, particularly the Roman Catholic Church, which makes this argument, that the church authorizes the canon. That's this idea over here. And that the canon, the rule, the list, is then the authoritative set of writings. I believe that's not the correct way to look at this idea of canonicity. What made a book canonical was not did the church authorize it, produce it, publish it, but did it recognize it as apostolic? Did it say, yes, this was written by John, this was written by Peter, this was written by whoever? So that the canon then is the set of authoritative writings, not the authoritative set of writings, authoritative because the church signed off on it, or because some council said it was so. They're authoritative writings, to be sure, but they're authoritative writings that bear on their face, in their character, in their text, the marks of apostolicity, that an apostle wrote this, so that the key criteria is apostolicity and not usage because it was on somebody's list necessarily, although there were lists, and very early on, the list began to settle on, yeah, there are 27 books that we recognize as canonical. My point is, I believe it's a more accurate view of this to say, is it apostolic? If it's on the list, it's on the list because it's apostolic. It's not canonical because it's on a list. That's the point I'm trying to make. This emphasizes God's authority in Scripture as opposed to His authority in church tradition, although I would grant that both of these approaches, on some level and at some point, both recognize God's authority in the Scriptures and through the church. Because it is in churches, in congregations, that we come together to read and to reflect about what it is that God wants us to do. Well, all right, the key is canon, is apostolicity. I'll just close with this quotation from Bruce Metzger. The Scriptures are authoritative and hence canonical. They're canonical because they are authoritative, because they're apostolic, because they are the extant, the existing literary deposit of the direct and indirect apostolic witness on which the later witness of the church depends. Now that is seminary speak, to be sure, but I believe it encapsulates the truth. Something is canonical because it's apostolic. It's authoritative because it's apostolic, not because some Roman Catholic theologian or some council said that it's so. They're leaning on the buzzer, so I think that means I'm supposed to quit. So I thank you very much, and we'll continue this discussion later.